This is a CBC podcast.
Support for delivery of this podcast comes from the all-new 2008 Cadillac CTS. Be an original. Visit Cadillac.gm.ca.
It's Thursday, November 1st. Stéphane Dion says he would consider rescinding the Conservative government's GST cuts if his party won the next election. Currently, Dion's threat to raise taxes is a key platform in the Liberal Party bid to not win the next election. This is The Current Podcast.
Hello, I'm Anna Maria Tremonti. You're listening to The Current. When Sheila Fraser speaks, politicians tremble. For the last 6 years, Canada's Auditor General has pored over the federal government's books with a rigor that has earned her equal parts respect and fear. Her reports on government spending over everything from bootlaces to bridge building, and those reports often attract a lot of attention and come with serious political consequences for elected officials. In her latest report, released on Tuesday, Sheila Fraser accused the federal government of neglecting border security, not doing enough to protect its top secret information, and failing to live up to its obligations on native land claims in the Western Arctic. But this time she was trumped by another government official bearing much sweeter news when the finance minister, Mr. Flaherty, announced tax cuts. Here is what Rob Russo, the Ottawa bureau chief for the Canadian Press, had to say about the two competing stories of the day.
Well, they were both big stories. They were both page one stories for a news organization. And we had very little notice of one and decent notice of the other. But that still meant that I had to apportion half of a small newsroom to one lockup and the other half to the other. It was a challenge. I think you go with what has the most impact for readers, listeners, and viewers. I think that's the decision you've got to make. Which one is going to have the most impact for your audience? And I think undoubtedly it was they call it an economic statement. It was in fact a budget, and it was a pocketbook budget. It was a budget that directly affected Canadians and consumers in a material way. So I thought that was by far the bigger story.
Well, it seems that in this news cycle, government accountability may have been overshadowed by tax cuts. So on today's program, we are giving the Auditor General our undivided attention. Sheila Fraser is in Ottawa. Good morning and welcome.
Good morning, Mr. Monty.
Well, I wanted to ask you about your findings, and I'm going to do that in just a moment. But first, were you surprised when you learned the government was releasing this economic update on the same day as your report?
Not really. These things have happened in the past, and there's often many events that will compete, if you will, with the news of our report. The important thing for us is the parliamentary hearings that will occur afterwards, where departments are held to account and where they will present their action plans.
And does it make it more difficult in your job if you're trying to focus attention on government accountability if people, including the media, are preoccupied with all the treats the government is offering?
Well, as I said, the real work for us starts with the parliamentary hearings, which I hope will start within the next week or so, and we'll appear with the departments concerned, and that's where the accountability process really becomes quite true. So perhaps there will be coverage later on.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, I'm thinking of when you came up with all the information that led to the whole issue of Gomery. Do you think the public has become desensitized to scandal emanating from reports such as yours?
I don't think so. Certainly judging by the interest that, you know, the so-called scandals seem to continue to generate. But I would just caution that those are really the rare occasions, and most of our reports, the vast, vast majority of our reports deal with the sort of management issues that we presented yesterday.
And they're still very important for us to know about. So let me ask you about some of what you did say in this report. You looked at the issue of security and the security of classified information in particular. What did you discover?
That actually was a very troubling audit, because the government has quite a system in place to ensure that people who have access to what they call classified or protected information, which can range from anything from, you know, personnel records up to national security information. There's a whole process to validate people and to give them what we call a security clearance. We found that process was not being respected rigorously, particularly in the in defense construction projects. Many contracts had begun and, in fact, even finished before security clearances were in place. We gave the example of the NORAD installation in North Bay, where there were no security checks done. And so there is a real need to ensure that that program, and a lot of it, I should add, is because the program wasn't funded properly. So there is a real need to give that proper funding to that program and to ensure that the policies are clear and people know what their responsibilities are.
So can I clarify, who should have had security checks or clearances who didn't?
Well, for example, one of the examples in this NORAD case were the people doing the construction of the building, which was to house very sensitive NORAD systems. There were no security clearances of the people doing that contract, which meant that the building could have been compromised.
And how many contractors are we talking about?
Oh, we would talk probably about dozens of contractors. And we found this in the majority of the contracts that were given for defense construction projects. It is not a simply, you know, a one-off. We were told quite bluntly that this was done in order to ensure that projects came in on time and within cost estimates. And so these security requirements were simply bypassed.
And so we are in a situation where our own government doesn't know if security was compromised. Is that correct?
Well, they have gone back for this particular project and have put in place, we have been told, mitigation procedures and have ensured that the building is secure, but they certainly ran the risk that it might not have been. This is happening in other places too, that in many cases contractors will begin work and the security clearances will come during the course of a contract. As long as there are mitigation procedures put in place and those people don't have access to sensitive information, I mean, that's a way to manage it, but preferably they would have those clearances in place before the work begins.
You say it happens in other places too. What other kinds of construction projects are you talking about?
We looked largely at defense construction. We also looked at the RCMP, and we looked at public works. And we found that there were weaknesses in those other places as well.
And when it comes to defense, and specifically the NORAD project, this is something that is done in conjunction with our allies, correct?
That's correct. This was the project, you may know in North Bay, there's an underground complex which houses NORAD systems. This building was to enable them to move these systems from below ground to above ground. And these are, of course, very sensitive systems. And we would have had the U.S. concurrence, the building was secure before those systems moved up.
And do you have any idea how the U.S. reacts to the idea that there wasn't security clearance then on these contractors?
No, I don't. Though I have been told that since then they have, the systems have been moved up, so it would be an indication that they are satisfied with the security arrangements that are in place.
You also examined border security, and this is an area in which the government has invested millions of dollars for improvements. Does your examination of this indicate that the border is any more secure?
What we looked at specifically was the agencies, the Border Services Agency's efforts to try to improve their risk management processes and their targeting of high-risk people and goods. I think we can all appreciate with the volume of traffic, be it people or merchandise that goes back and forth across the border, it's impossible for the Border Services Agencies to inspect every person and every shipment. So it's very important that they are able to identify high-risk individuals and goods. We have a number of recommendations. We recognize that this is not easy to do. They are still in the early stages of much of the implementation of this strategy. They have put in, as you mentioned, they are investing a fair bit of money in computer systems, collecting much more information. They have work to do on their overall strategy. And one criticism in particular, which we've had actually for many years, and we have repeated, is that they don't keep enough information about the results of their inspections to know if the actual targeting they're doing is effective or not. And they don't do random inspections, which really is the only way to check if your system is efficient and effective or not.
So what you're saying is that there are great numbers of unknowns at a time when our government says we need secure borders.
That's right. For example, we have some information in there about cargo shipments that are coming into the country. where there were certain containers that were indicated that shouldn't be shipped, that yet they were allowed in. They had been identified initially as high risk, and we don't know why they were allowed in. It could be that the border agents received additional information and decided that they were did not present a risk, but there's no indications anywhere as to that. And this kind of information is absolutely critical to ensure that appropriate measures are taken, that it wasn't simply a mistake and something came in that was identified as high risk.
You know, earlier this week we were talking about the allegations that two Americans were trying to sell F-14 parts to Iran through Canada. And the argument was that Canada can be a market as the third country to sell things that are illegal for sale in third countries because of the way our customs works, that in fact too many of our customs agents are busy collecting taxes from visitors and regular travelers. Did you look at sort of the use of manpower in that way?
Not really. We looked at it from the point of view that with a risk-based approach, you should allocate your resources where you believe the risks are the highest. And we found that the agency is still going pretty much on historic resourcing levels and aren't using this risk-based approach in order to allocate resources to the various border points. I think you are correct, though, in saying that, you know, for many, many years, obviously border service agencies, one of their most important duties was to collect customs and duties. And it does take time to change the focus to more of a security one rather than from collection of taxes.
I want to move on to the whole issue of the environment. In 1995, the government introduced a law to ensure federal departments consider how their actions might have an impact on climate change or other environmental issues. How seriously are departments taking this?
You're right. In 1995, they introduced what we call sustainable development strategies. The larger departments, there are now 32 that are either required or voluntarily complete them, do these strategies every 3 years. The Commissioner of the Environment, which is part of our, who is part of our office, has a mandate to audit these, and consistently over the past 10, 12 years has said that the strategies are not meaningful. As Mr. Thompson said yesterday, you know, it's little more than a paper exercise to fulfill a statutory obligation. One of the major problems that we see there is that there isn't an overall sustainable development strategy for the government as a whole, which would then indicate to departments on what to concentrate. It's more of a bottom-up exercise and is not very meaningful, and many of the commitments that are made are not followed through on.
And who bears the responsibility for that in the departments then? Is it the deputy ministers?
Well, ultimately, the deputy minister would be responsible for most of the management within the department. What we found, though, is there are really no consequences for these strategies not working. So the commissioner and I have called upon the government to conduct a really thorough review to understand why they're not working, to see what has to be done to make this tool, which could be, you know, very useful, to make it actually meaningful. There's a lot of time and effort that goes into preparing these strategies. One would hope that it would be effective.
Mm. I also want to ask you about the what was called the Inuvialuit Final Agreement, that a native land claim that the government signed 23 years ago, and you have found fault with how Ottawa is living up to its side of this bargain.
Absolutely. I think this is one of the more disappointing stories in our report yesterday. That 23 years after a land claim agreement was signed, many parcels of land have not been transferred. The Inuvialuit were to be informed about contracts in their region. We found that that was not being done, in fact, because the government doesn't have the systems to be able to identify them. And perhaps, the most troubling was that the government departments didn't even know what their commitments were under this agreement and who was responsible for carrying them out. And there's still very much an attitude that we noted a few years ago when we looked at another agreement, that Indian Northern Affairs, the staff, tend to rely very much on the specific obligations they have to carry out and feel no responsibility to working with the Aboriginal people to fulfill the goals of the agreement, so better economic well-being. And, you know, I find this really troubling, quite frankly, that that there seems to be an attitude that success is signing the agreement and then everyone sort of goes home and nobody seems to worry very much about implementation.
Mm, and these are really problems then of successive governments.
We're looking absolutely
at 23 years.
Absolutely.
And do you get any kind of assurances that this will be looked at? As you make the point, it's not the first time you've pointed this out.
Well, the government departments have certainly, in all of the reports, indicated that they agree with the recommendations. We will be going before parliamentary committees on these reports. Generally, the departments will present action plans, and the committees are pretty good at reviewing the plans and making sure that they are detailed with clear responsibilities and timelines. And then we will go back at some point in the future when it's appropriate to re-audit and ensure that government has lived up to its commitments.
And you say you go back at when it's appropriate. Do they have a deadline that you give them that you'll check in a certain amount of time?
Well, we rely very much on their own action plans. We used to, in the past, kind of go back after 2 years. Sometimes, to be quite honest, that isn't long enough to resolve some of these issues. So we would rather that the department themselves set the timeline, depending upon the other priorities that they may have, and then we will hold them to account for meeting their own commitments.
And can I ask a little bit more about holding them to account? How much power do you have to force them to change?
We really only have the power of recommendation, but I can assure you that appearing before parliamentary committees and having parliamentary reports in the House of Commons, no department wants to have that go badly. And we have one report each year, which we present in February, that we call our status report, which is strictly devoted to follow-up.
And so is the pressure, does it work?
Yes, I believe it does work. I believe fundamentally government departments are committed to good management and do want to resolve these issues. The problem is often that there is a lack of, I think, sustained attention to issues. Sometimes there are funding pressures. But when we look at our follow-up reports, the majority of the reports have been positive, that mm-hmm. the departments are making satisfactory progress.
And yet, if we look at the Inuvialuit final agreement, 23 years, when does this become a matter of political will versus departmental getting it together?
I agree with you there. I mean, 23 years is unacceptable. And just the fact that they don't even know what their obligations are, it's not surprising that some of them haven't been met. So you would expect that there would be much more attention paid to implementation. It could be a question of resourcing again, but clearly with the increase in the number of land claim agreements since the Inuvialuit one, though that was one of the first ones, government has to pay much more attention to implementation of these agreements.
Do you ever get the sense that your reports become a bit of a political football, that the government will pay more attention when it serves its own interest?
I think we note that when we start an audit or advise departments of an audit, that they begin perhaps to look more closely at how they're managing in that particular area.
Is that fear?
Well, I think they don't. I mean, I think it's probably human nature that if you would rather find out things yourself than have someone else tell it to you publicly. And that's not a bad thing. If they begin to work and to correct issues as we're going along, we will certainly give them credit for it.
And I guess that's my other question. Some of these some of these concerns you raise before the report even comes out, do you not? You start talking to them ahead of time?
Oh, yes. Our audits take up to about 18 months to do. Of course, during the course of the audit, there's a lot of communication back and forth with the department. They are informed of the findings of the report, and we go through a process that we call validation of facts. So we ask actually the deputy minister at the end of the audit to confirm to us that the facts are correct and to provide the responses to the audit.
Okay. When's your next report due?
Well, the next report will be in February, at least it's scheduled for February. That will be a report from the Commissioner of the Environment, a follow-up on a number of audits, I think up to 14 audits, that the Commissioners of the Environment have done in the past. on a number of very number of very important issues.
Well, we'll put that in our calendar. Sheila Fraser, thank you.
Thank you.
Sheila Fraser is the Auditor General of Canada. She released her latest findings on Tuesday, and she was in our Ottawa studio. Well, that's all we have for this podcast. You can listen to The Current weekday mornings on CBC Radio 1 right after the 8:30 news, as well as on Sirius Satellite Radio 137. To find out more about our program, visit cbc.ca/thecurrent. If you have any thoughts on what you're hearing on The Current, share them with us. Send us your comments. You can email us at thecurrent, all one word, thecurrent@cbc.ca. Our mailing address is Post Office Box 500, Station A, Toronto, M5W1E6. Or call us collect 1-877-287-7366. To subscribe to other great CBC Radio podcasts, check out cbc.ca/podcasting. Thanks for listening. I'm Anna Maria Tremonti.
Hi, I'm Jesse Brown. I'm the host of Search Engine, a new CBC Radio show that is all about how the internet is changing politics and culture. It's not a gadget show. We don't really care much about technology so much as we care about the effect that technology is having on the world that we live in. All of the surprising and significant and funny stories that we bring you on Search Engine are about things that are happening right now. In the short time that we've been on the air, we've already become the CBC's most popular news podcast in the States. So come find out why. Subscribe to our podcast on CBC's podcasting page or through iTunes.